From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Jim Hightower on the telecommunications bill and the dangers media mega-mergers pose to freedom of speech.
On Saturday, I went on the air and blasted both the Disney-ABC merger and the passage of the telecommunications bill as an infringement of our democracy, as being exactly the wrong direction for media to be headed. I came on complete with a little Mickey Mouse character doing the voice impersonation. Donald Duck was with us as well. Goofy was there. And acknowledge that I now work for a rodent. My radio career was very short-lived after that comment.
And the ecology of rich and poor. We'll talk to the author of Divided Planet, a new book that links environmentalism with economic justice. All this coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. Bob Dole yesterday ridiculed President Clinton's foreign policy in a speech trumpeted as a foreign policy manifesto. Dole relented only once, endorsing Clinton's plan to renew most favored nation trade privileges for China when they expire next month. He called his differences with Clinton vast and fundamental, from expansion of NATO and the deployment of ballistic missile defenses to over-reliance on the United Nations and decisive action on the enemies of the United States. And this story from Alabama, a white state senator running for Congress wrote a speech in which he argued that slavery is justified by the Bible and is good for blacks. Charles Davidson wrote, "People who are bitter and hateful about slavery are obviously bitter and hateful against God and his word because they reject what God says and embrace what mere humans say concerning slavery." He wrote, "The incidents of abuse, rape, broken homes, and murder are 100 times greater today in the housing projects than they ever were on the slave plantations in the Old South." Davidson is a Republican from Jasper, Alabama, and had prepared the speech for a Senate debate over his proposal to fly the Confederate battle flag over the Capitol. The measure was tabled before he had a chance to speak, but he passed out copies later. He also wrote, "The truth is that nowhere on the face of the earth and all of time were servants better treated or better loved than they were in the Old South by white, black, Hispanic, and Indian slave owners." Davidson is a restaurateur elected to the state Senate in 1994. He's running for the GOP nomination for the U.S. House seat being vacated by Democrat Tom Bevel. The primary is June 4th. With some satirical commentary on this trend of thought, we offer you The Sturdy Beggars.
And now it's time once again for Historical Rush Limbaugh. The year is 1865, and Rush is discussing the abolition of slavery.
You see, my friends, what these Yankees, these liberal abolitionists, are trying to do is, by ramming through this liberal big government program, which mandates that everyone treat Negroes not as property, but as human beings, if you can believe it, Negroes as human beings, by forcing on us this liberal interventionist big government program, not only will they ruin the economic viability of the slaveholders, but they will destroy the individual initiative of the slave traders, which is what makes the Confederacy great. Now, I'm not saying there are no slaves out there. I'm sure there are some, though nowhere near as many as the elite liberal media would have you believe. Nor is it probably as bad to be a slave as the media tend to portray it, you know? Oh, the poor slaves! They're separated from their families! They're sold at auction! Boo-hoo! The bottom line, my friends, if a Negro slave feels that he is human instead of three-fifths human, which the property law states, then he should simply request his rights from the plantation overseer and not expect the federal government to solve his problem for him.
Tune in again next week on Historical Rush Limbaugh when Rush will discuss the Great Depression.
My friends, just because we are going through a very brief period of economic downsizing, that does not entitle the temporarily unemployed to free soup.
That's next week on Historical Rush Limbaugh.
And those are the Sturdy Beggars. We welcome any of your submissions of political satire or music. We will give our address at the end of the show. You're listening to Democracy Now! Jim Hightower is one of America's most popular populists. He's an author, public speaker, radio host, former editor of the Texas Observer, and former Texas Agriculture Commissioner. Hightower spoke last week in New York City at an event celebrating the 20th anniversary of Project Censored, a group which documents the most underreported but critically important stories of the year. In this speech, he talks about censorship of ideas and dissident voices in the corporate media.
Thank you very much. I'm honored that you would allow a scrawny Texan like myself to come these 1,500 miles here tonight to fill in for Ralph Nader. My comments will be shorter than the brief that he submitted to Mark. But more importantly, to be a part of this celebration, this award ceremony, this all-night hog-calling contest that we're a part of here at the Ethical Cultural Center, gathered together to celebrate tonight's awardees, to be sure, celebrate 20 years of Project Censored, but especially, I think, to celebrate that rowdy and raucous spirit of true journalism, of real journalism in our country. I think it boils down to an old cowboy saying, tell the truth, but ride a fast horse. You know what I mean? I've been there. Just, in fact, a brief autobiographical interlude here. I come to you tonight with a checkered past myself, having been someone who has both covered the news and been the coveree in the news. I've seen the media from both sides. As editor of the Texas Observer some years ago, late 1970s, but then in 1980 made the only downward career move one can make from journalism, and that was to go into politics. And lo and behold, managed to actually get elected, much to my surprise and the surprise of the political establishment in that state. So I've seen the owners, the publishers, the editors, and even, sadly, the reporters increasingly bastardize the news, marginalize and trivialize the news, and, of course, ignore the news, which is what we're here to discuss tonight. In my 20-odd years of involvement in the journalistic endeavor, I find one truism that really has been expressed so well over the years by Ben Bagdikian, and that is that as media ownership becomes more corporatized, media coverage becomes more corporatized. Big surprise, right? I mean, if you got ugly parents, chances are you're going to have an ugly child. It's just that simple. And that's pretty much what's going on in the media today. Words like big, huge, and giant no longer suffice at all. They just don't tell the story of media concentration. We need adjectives now. Galloping, gobbling, gargantuan, greedy Goliaths of the media just come to mind, just dealing with the G's in the alphabet. Now, I've got to say to you, in the full spirit of a consumer disclosure, to say that I've had my own personal experience with this. I've come up hard against media concentration as a minor media sparkly. And one of the only actual progressives with a national talk show on radio, certainly the only populist with a nationally syndicated talk show on ABC Cap Cities last year, and genuinely populist. How populist was it? Our 800 number was 1-800-AGITATE, just to give you some clue as to what our spirit was all about. Again, that's true spirit of American journalism, of advocacy journalism, willing to tell the truth and then get on that fast horse. We were an oddity on my show and continue to be in the daily commentaries that I do, an oddity on mainstream media, of someone willing to preach class warfare. You know, Phil Graham, Bob Dole, they're always out there saying, why are you just talking about class warfare? Well, damn right we're talking about it. Been class warfare for 20 years. We're going to start fighting back for a change. That's all there is to that. Well, things were going wrong rather splendidly on my show. Had 150 markets, larger coverage than even Rush Limbaugh his own self had achieved at that point in Limbaugh's nationally syndicated career. Of course, you know, as you know, Rush Limbaugh is the biggest thing in radio. I believe if you were to render the BS out of him, though, he'd fit in a matchbox. But that's another story. We were gaining ground, doing well, until August 5th last year, when it was announced that Disney was taking over ABC Cap Cities. That was on a Monday. On Friday of that week, the Senate passed the telecommunications bill. On Saturday, I went on the air and blasted both the Disney-ABC merger and the passage of the telecommunications bill as an infringement of our democracy, as being exactly the wrong direction for media to be headed. I came on complete with a little Mickey Mouse character doing the voice impersonation. Donald Duck was with us as well. Goofy was there. And acknowledge that I now work for a rodent. My radio career was very short-lived after that comment. In fact, the next week, there was a noticeable chill in my relationship with ABC, and within 6 weeks, I was gone. No great loss in my own demise on ABC. In fact, I think the surprise is not that I was booted by the Mickey, but rather that I was on the air for a year and a half talking about what I was talking about on ABC Cap Cities. I think of a tombstone I once saw in Boot Hill, Arizona, said, "I was expecting this, but not so soon." My own demise was of no consequence whatsoever, but what is important is the loss of the viewpoint. And that is not a loss that is reflected just in myself. Because what's happened now is that big money is in a position to decide what is talked about on talk radio, as well as in other aspects of the media. And the one thing we have learned that they definitely do not want talked about is big money. You can get on the air and talk about abortion from a liberal viewpoint. You can talk about immigration. You can talk about any of the social issues from a liberal viewpoint. You cannot, however, get on the air and talk about big money. You cannot be a populist on the air and talk about the powers that be that own the big media today. I'm not alone in being stiff. Mark, I think, mentioned our friend Jeff Cohen and FAIR. Crossfire just recently had a tremendous opportunity to serve the public when Michael Kinsley, liberal light, we call him, decided to take a hike from that show and go out to work for Bill Gates out in La La Land somewhere. They had the opportunity then to put a progressive on that show to counter John Sununu and Michael Barnes and all the rest of them. Who to choose? Christopher Hitchens was in the running, the great writer for The Nation. Jeff Cohen then became sort of the consensus nominee, those of us on the progressive side. Was Jeff chosen? No, 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 Jeff was not chosen. Who was chosen? They decided to take two liberals and put them on the air. So now we have Jerry Ferraro and Bill Press. Now, these are two fine human beings, but they are to liberalism and they are to populism what near beer is to beer. Only not so close. Now, why were they chosen? Well, Crossfire said that their standard of being a liberal on Crossfire was whether you would defend Bill Clinton or not. So that is, at least on CNN, the range of America's political debate, ranging from the corporate right viewpoint of Bill Clinton to the wacky right viewpoint of Newt Gingrich. Kind of like the death penalty. Do you want electrocution or the more humane lethal injection method, it seems to me, that we're being offered there. Now along comes the Terminator, the Telecommunications Act of 1996, the top-centered story. Project Censor. This piece of legislation is an absolute wet dream for the media conglomerates and Wall Street. They would have us believe that it was passed to assist consumers, to enhance competition, to produce jobs. Do we look like we have sucker wrappers around our heads? I mean, think about that. Consumers, our rates are going up already after the passage of that legislation, just a scant 2 or 3 months ago. Jobs? Being drop-kicked through the goalpost of corporate greed all across the country. Ask the employees of 9X and Bell Atlantic about that. Competition? Phone companies, cable systems, TV networks, radio stations, buying each other up faster than a hog eats supper. The greatest damage that it does, though, is not to us as consumers and as workers, but to us as citizens. Because we're not talking about the monopolization of toasters and television sets. We're talking about the monopolization of our access to information and to viewpoints, the very stuff of our democracy. Oh, they exclaim, not to worry about this at all, not to be bothered by it. They say, we cover all viewpoints. We care about our public responsibilities. Trust us, they say. Does a chicken trust Colonel Sanders? Let me ask you that. Let's just visit one thing. Where was the coverage of the telecommunications bill itself? It did not exist. It passed on a Thursday. Wednesday night, there was no mention of it on the networks. Wednesday in the New York Times, there was no mention of it the day before the passage. Any coverage that it had received leading up to the passage on a Thursday had been about the, made it sound like it was a fight between the baby bells and AT&T. That it had nothing to do with you and me, had nothing to do with our democracy. Here's the my own local paper, product of the Cox chain, Austin American Statesman. All kinds of story. We just had a major sleet storm. We got up to an eighth of an inch the day before. So it was very widely covered. We had full coverage of that. Dole and Forbes, that was very important. Nick Gingrich talking about a smaller tax cut. Some murders, of course, 0 degrees, more coverage of the eighth of an inch sleet storm that we had. Restaurants are missing the lobbyists in Capitol Hill restaurants. Nowhere is there any mention of the telecommunication bill. This is the coverage of the bill after it had passed until you get to Section D. And here it is. Telecom bill sales quickly to Clinton. Congress voted Thursday to free the exploding television, telephone, and home computer industries. Da-da-da-da. On and on. Approximately 3.5 inches coverage here. No mention of what it means to consumers. No mention of what it means to our own democracy. If they're not going to cover the telecommunication bill itself, then they're not going to cover our democracy once they have this monopoly power. Well, you say, Hightower, what are we to do? Are we doomed? Do we surrender? Not at all. We do what we are here to celebrate tonight. We do what these journalists, whether they actually work for a media outlet or not, they are journalists in that spirit of kicking butt and taking names, facing the powers that be on behalf of the powers that ought to be in this country. We challenge the powers that be. We confront them. And that is our challenge, to recreate a public media. A media that's responsive and responsible to the public rather than just to Wall Street. We have, after all, been here before, and we do have to remember that. Back about 100 years ago, a little earlier than that, 110 years ago, similar situation existed. The People's Party, the populace, and at that age were shut out, got no coverage of their issues, got no coverage of their movement. So they created their own media. At the time, newspapers, a national magazine, a speaker's bureau with 20,000 members in it, they found their way around the media blockage. That's our responsibility, it seems to me, in the 1990s. My mama taught me that two wrongs don't make a right, but I soon figured out that three left turns do. That is our... Some of you slower ones might want to pencil that out. That is what we're about and what Project Censored really is about. Folks like we will honor here tonight, people who have figured out the three left turns that can make a difference for us. Tonight's awardees are an example of that. All of the alternative press, the internet itself, community radio, pirate radio, access television, right across the board. I'm venturing out to some degree in this my own self, not only through continuing radio commentaries, a newsletter that I'm about to launch, but there is an argument I've been making for some time is that our side must buy assets. We must own our own publications. We must own our own radio stations, and to the degree to which we can, even television, but certainly we can on radio. And I'm about to have a new national talk show on, and I can't go into any great detail on here tonight because it's not complete. It will be next week, but in a new radio network that is taking over an existing network and expanding it, that will be substantially owned by a major union in the country, putting assets where they belong and putting our kind of voice on the air in a way that our voice cannot be taken off of the air. My point is, we can do this. We've done it before, 100 years ago. We're smart enough to do it today, and the best news is that we are doing it. And I know a lot of people say, oh, no, they're too big this time. They're too concentrated. They're too powerful. Too much money is at stake. Well, I'll leave you with this thought, and we'll get on to the awardees, which is the important point. Just remember this if you don't remember anything else. No building is too tall for even a small dog to lift his leg on. Thank you very much for watching.
Jim Hightower, former editor of the Texas Observer, former Texas Agriculture Commissioner, and ex-WABC radio talk show host. He was speaking just a few days ago at the Project Censored Awards in New York City. You're listening to Democracy Now! Listening to Democracy Now!, the only daily election show in public broadcasting. I'm Amy Goodman. Many of us call ourselves environmentalists because we recycle our trash, maybe cut down on driving, shop for energy-efficient products. We think these things are changes in behavior and that they're making a difference. But Tom Athanasiou says we're wrong. In his new book, Divided Planet, The Ecology of Rich and Poor, Athanasiou argues that only radical social and economic changes will reverse the disastrous destruction of our environment. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tom.
Thanks.
So this isn't happening right now?
I don't think so. I mean, just to cut to the chase, my claim is that inconvenient though it may be, the global environmental crisis is real, and that because of the extreme and increasing polarization of wealth and power at the planetary level, it's going to be very difficult for us to deal with it.
Those issues, wealth and power, are not often the central issues of the environmental movement, particularly mainstream environmental organizations today in the United States. How do you link the two?
Well, I actually consider that we're in a transitional period in the history of the modern environmental movement. And environmentalism, as we have mostly known it in the last couple of decades, which has been basically the preserve of middle-class nature lovers, as significant as that movement has been, I think it is being superseded, taken into a larger movement which sees environmental protection as intimately bound with questions of justice and economic democracy and so on and so forth. What my book tries to do is to take those issues at the global level and integrate them with biogeography, to take a serious look at the ecological deterioration, because it's not something that can be put off until after we have a more democratic society, and at the same time to look at institutions, public relations, the whole bit.
If it's not the big environmental groups that are taking on this issue, who is pushing these issues of economic justice to the fore?
Just about everybody in the environmental movement, even some of the scientists. There, estimates of the total number of environmental groups in the world place the figure somewhere above 100,000. So you have to be clear. I mean, that's globally. That's counting every community organization and every mega NGO. It's an extremely diverse and extremely densely networked organization of people and journals and scientists and politicians. There's good people and bad people at all levels, from the level of international diplomacy down. The fact that some of the large Washington-based organizations have been playing a problematic role in the construction of a new environmental movement does not mean even that those organizations are monolithic. I mean, one of the things I like to point out is that just because the executives of some of the big Washington organizations supported NAFTA does not necessarily mean that the staff members of those organizations supported NAFTA.
But what difference does it make that the staff members didn't support NAFTA? The word out, the official word, what helped get NAFTA passed was these endorsements.
Right, right. But NAFTA is a disaster, and even some of the groups that supported it. NAFTA is a disaster. And even some of the Washington-based groups that supported it are embarrassed by the reality. So, you know, this is a learning process. You know, actually, in a way, there was something good about NAFTA, which is that the debate about NAFTA and all that it portends was quite educational for a really large number of people. I mean, by and large, people in the environmental movement today after NAFTA are much more sophisticated about the relationship of economic issues to ecological issues than they were a year ago. And you can't, if you're in this for the long haul, you can't write that to zero. I mean, that's a significant fact. Same thing with the Earth Summit, even though officially the Earth Summit was smoke and mirrors to an immense degree, unsaid, you know, is exactly what it says. All the real issues were unsaid. Doesn't mean that there wasn't a lot of good done in terms of the networking, the number of people who met other people that were like-minded in other countries. And these are significant developments. You know.
We're talking with Tom Athanasiou, and he is author of Divided Planet, The Ecology of Rich and Poor. How did you get involved with the environmental movement? Because you're not just a writer.
I've been in the environmental movement at its fringes for a long time, since 1971, when I was involved with recycling in Berkeley, California. And the way I sold the book to Little Brown was basically I said, I'm the only person in the world that knows personally one of the founders of Earth First and also knows personally environmental activists working within the World Bank trying to reform it. I know a lot of different people. And but I was, even though I was an ecology activist early on, I couldn't stand the ecology movement. So it was just too much dithering and too much surface analysis, too much. You know, I'll tell you how I got started thinking about it. We were working in a recycling center in 1971, and we were selling glass to a huge company named Owens Corning. And we noticed, I noticed one day that they were paying us out of their public relations budget. And I just started asking people, well, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, why are they paying us out of the PR budget? And it took me a long, long time to get a proper answer to that question. I hope that that answer is in Divided Planet, which has a major chapter in it called The Age of Greenwashing.
Well, let's talk about greenwashing and public relations and how the surge of money and PR that came from the corporations was directly funneled to the big environmental groups when they were perhaps at their poorest.
Well, that's an important point. But the place to begin with greenwashing is to make sure that people understand its scale. I mean, first of all, the public relations industry is a branch, a small branch of the advertising industry. Okay, so first of all, you have to know the scale of the advertising industry. It's currently estimated to be about $355 billion a year and expanding very, very rapidly, particularly in the third world. Okay, public relations industry is huge. Tens of billions of dollars, but much smaller than the advertising industry, which essentially owns the large PR companies. Then within the public relations sectors, you have a sector that has specialized in what's called green public relations. And a turning point for green public relations was the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which was a PR disaster for Exxon. And the reason it was a PR disaster for Exxon is that the execs handled it in a really ham-handed way. And ever since then, executives have known that they have to pay much more attention to appearances than they used to.
Well, I remember what happened with the Exxon Valdez. You had some really crusading journalists who were up in Alaska who were talking about what was going on. And soon they became, with a large money incentive, PR people for Exxon. In fact, didn't also Exxon give a tremendous contribution to the Alaska Public Radio Network? And when it was exposed, APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, was forced to return it.
Oh, I didn't even know that. Yeah, yeah. That's there's a lot of that going on. I mean, after the Gulf War and the sort of collapse of mainstream, the mainstream environmental organizations are, you know, really not activist organizations. They're basically fundraising-based organizations. And when ecology last ceased to be the fashion, which was about the after the collapse of the Gulf War, fundraising dropped, and the corporations really started moving in at that point and funding some of the larger environmental organizations and trying to buy some influence. But you know, I don't want to exaggerate that. I mean, there is a lot of money, corporate money in the environmental movement, but by and large, that's not what's. I mean, we would probably have a great agreement about the problems in the environmental movement, and it's got a lot to do with money. But there are other problems as well, like what would it take to stop the planetary deterioration is a question that there's disagreements about, and whether what the proper role of the market is in the management of the ecological crisis is a question that there would be really fundamental disagreement about, even if the corporations weren't trying to buy influence in the movement. You see,
do you think capitalism is the enemy of the environment?
I think that. The green movement has made a claim for a long time.
What do you mean when you say the green movement?
Well, I use the green movement to mean everybody, all this 100,000 groups, including the most bureaucratic and technocratic Washington-based groups, and including the most radical environmental justice groups in the third world that would not call themselves environmental groups. I just lump them all together in the green movement, which is, I sometimes contrast to the red movement, which is an equally diverse group. And I, you know, to answer your question, the only word that I am interested in saving from the old left lexicon is capitalism. I think we can let all the rest of it go. But we have to talk about capitalism because it is completely hegemonic. If we don't talk about it, we're doomed to not be able to talk about, you know, we're like fish that can't talk about water. You
know? So how should it be talked about, do you think?
I use the word capitalism. And
how should capitalism be talked about?
In as straightforward and non-ideological a way as possible.
How does capitalism hurt the environment?
Well,
how does it work?
Well, there's a question as to whether or not in the long term you can have a capitalist economy that does not need to grow. It's a very, very fundamental question. Greens have been raising it for decades. People at all levels have pretended to refute the green intuition that capitalism must grow or die, as Murray Bookchin, one of the founders of the radical environmental movement, put it decades ago. But in my opinion, that claim has never been adequately refuted. It's an open question as to whether or not capitalism can adapt to a system that does not need to destroy the ecosystem in order to survive. I really do not believe that we know the answer to that question. Radicals for centuries now have underestimated the adaptability of the capitalist system. I'm not interested in repeating that mistake. I think we The question is, what would the political strategy be that would maximize the adaptability of the movement of the existing institutional matrix, which embodies capitalism, into one that didn't need to tear down the fundamental structures of the ecosystem? I don't know if it can be done.
Have you seen any challenges that have worked, any strategies anywhere in the world?
Well, there's all kinds of strategies that have worked locally for brief periods of time. In general, I don't think this situation is a pretty one. The 20th century has been a bloody and deadly century with two global wars, the emergence of nuclear power, and so on and so on. The 21st century really does promise to be much worse. As we go into the beginning of the 21st century, ecological pressure globally is much higher. The ecosystems are in a much more deteriorated state. The population globally is much higher. And the world is abrim with the frustrated, the angry, the highly mobile, and the well-armed. And it's not a pretty picture. There's a new period of capitalist expansion, of course, beginning in Asia, a major, major period of absolutely unregulated and uncontrolled capitalist growth beginning in China, Southeast Asia, and so on and so forth. China is booming. Its boom is an ecological catastrophe. It is not, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many other people, going to be possible for Chinese capitalism to develop in the way that Euro-American capitalism developed in the last couple of hundred years. But the question politically is, what would make things happen differently over there?
You know, Bob Dole yesterday gave his major foreign policy address. He called it his foreign policy manifesto. And the one area where he said he agrees with Clinton, although it doesn't sound like overall they disagree that much, is on the issue of most favored nation trade status for China. Now, the issue of the environment in China did not come into his talk, as I don't hear President Clinton talking about the environment in China. What do you think, specifically, since people don't get to really hear a lot about what's going on inside China, it's always U.S. policy towards China, is happening there? What are the specific environmental
threats?
It
would take a long time to talk about China, but just to hit the headlines, there's quite extensive use of prison-based slave labor in China, run by the People's Liberation Army in many cases, which is a giant conglomerate at this point. And of course, in terms of environmental deterioration, there's not much good to be said about the situation in China. Though, believe it or not, the Chinese government is more seriously committed to green economic planning than the American government. That is something. They're really, really trying to impose energy efficient policies, for example. I know this is surprising, I mean, especially given the fact that they're also doing things like Three Gorges Dam, which is going to utterly destroy the river valley of the Yangtze River. It displaced 1.5 billion people. 1.5 million people is a long story. But in terms of the trade thing and Dole's speech, my position, which is the position of many people in the environmental movement, is that international trade needs to be conditioned by fundamental labor, human, and environmental constraints. That if you produce something by using slave labor, or if you produce something by destroying the environment, beyond a certain point, you should not be allowed to sell that.
You mean impose obstacles to trade?
Yeah, well, you know, you have to be very clear about this. Yes, I have a long discussion in my book about the debate about trade and an explanation of what Greens mean by fair trade. I think we have to be really clear about this, though. It really is true that we cannot be protectionists. Protectionism will lead to war. That is true. And so when
of course, the United States grew up under protectionism. It's how its economy grew, not to mention Britain and all the other countries.
It's a very, very complicated story. But you know, the green alternative cannot just simply be old-style protectionism. And that's not what Greens mean by fair trade. But, you know, whether or not Whether or not that's what Dole means or that's what Clinton means, that's a completely different story. I mean, they've passed GATT and they've passed NAFTA now, and we're stuck with the World Trade Organization, and it's a startlingly undemocratic organization. It even makes the World Bank look democratic in comparison.
Who are the heads of the World Trade Organization, the ones who are making the decisions?
I have no idea.
I guess that tells us a lot.
Yeah, the World Bank, the WTO is a very opaque organization. One of the things that we have to do is democratize it, as we also have to democratize the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and, by the way, the United Nations.
How is that going
to
happen?
It's not going to be easy, but it's very, very clear that we need a set of powerful and democratic global institutions.
We'll talk more about that in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and Tom Athanasiou is our guest. He is author of the new book, profound book, Divided Planet, The Ecology of Rich and Poor. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Global warming in the quality of the world's ecosystems are increasing. Illnesses from waterborne organisms and from diseases such as malaria, dengue fever, and Lyme disease. This according to a group of environmentalists, senior managers of government and non-governmental organizations from around the world who ended a two-week conference in New York. Again, global warming and a decline in the quality of the world's ecosystems, increasing illnesses around the world. And I'm taking a look at a new book called Divided Planet, The Ecology of Rich and Poor by Tom Athanasiou. And in the second chapter, it's called Apocalyptics. And I just want to read a quote that he quotes from Susan Sontag. A permanent modern scenario. Apocalypse looms and it doesn't occur. Apocalypse has become an event that is happening and not happening. It may be that some of the most feared events, like those involving the irreparable ruin of the environment, have already happened. But we don't know it yet because the standards have changed, or because we don't have the right indexes for measuring the catastrophe, or simply because this is a catastrophe in slow motion. Now, there's a lot of complexity here, but it seems that the right-wing forces in Congress now are able to use the issue of how the apocalyptic vision of the environmental movement has been used to say, see, it hasn't happened.
Early eco-apocalyptics of the 1970s, like the people who wrote The Limits to Growth, were almost entirely right. They were wrong about one thing, and it's really important to be clear about what they were wrong about. Excuse me. They were wrong about us running out of natural resources like metals and oil and stuff like that. In fact, it would be great if we were running out of oil, and especially it would be really great if we were running out of coal. We're unfortunately not running out of coal. We have enough to cook very nicely and slowly if we keep burning it. The other thing, of course, that the early apocalyptics were wrong about was that many of them overemphasized the significance of population. It's not. The ecological crisis, inconvenient though it may be, is very real, but it is not fundamentally a problem, a crisis of overpopulation.
In fact, taking on that issue of population, many people felt really cast a kind of racist tinge to the environmental movement as they started to talk about, you look at the places that have the largest amount of population, they have to decrease their population, which didn't bring in that economic analysis that people here are using more resources than anywhere else.
That's right. And overpopulation is basically a polite way of saying too many brown and black babies. It's not the problem. Though, having said that, I will say that in the projections for the 21st century, we're probably going to go to 12 billion people globally, and it is going to be a squeaker. I mean, it's not going to be easy, and population is clearly a factor biologically. It's simply that it's not a causal factor politically. It's an important distinction.
But don't also you have to look at who is using the resources.
That's correct. Of the children born in, projected to be born in the decade of the 1990s, there will be about 57 million children born in the industrial north and about 911 million children born in the developing or underdeveloping south. The 57 million northern children will use more resources and generate more pollution than the 911 million southern children.
Why the lack of awareness in this country overall, if you look at the American population, about environmental issues and environmental destruction, we want to have a clean park for our kid to play in?
I mean, that's a really good question, particularly since the polls indicate that about 90% of the American population consistently identifies themselves as environmentalists. How come all these people are so unsophisticated about the structure of the international environment and the connections between it and ecological deterioration? I would have to say that a big part of the blame goes with the mainstream environmental organizations that have, by and large, proceeded by waving figures of endangered, charismatic megafauna like the tiger and the elephant, and fundraising, and not ever getting into deeper and political analysis.
We're talking to Tom Athanasiou, who is author of Divided Planet, The Ecology of Rich and Poor, a very interesting book. I'm wondering if you got a chance to see Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair's article in the Progressive magazine called Slime Green, or Green Slime, however you want to look at it, which was a fierce critique of the green establishment.
Right. You can't be in this game without reading the Colburn St. Clair stuff. Though I will say that I'm not sure I agree with their political strategy, which is to destroy the mainstream groups. It seems to me that we have allies in Washington and we have allies in the United Nations. We even have allies in the bank. It's a mixed bag at every level. You know, not all the grassroots organizations are unsullied pictures of virtue and rectitude. What we have to do is find a way to structure an environmental and not just environmental movement such that the fundamental questions of justice and democracy are the operational and ruling questions at all levels.
You know, just a few months ago, I was here in Washington covering the 50 Years is Enough campaign. It's now 51 years, I guess, looking at the World Bank, the IMF, and what they have done around the world. The organizers of it, the International Rivers Network, and it's a group that you complement in this book, in fact, that you've been a part of, talk about as your inspiration. Let's talk about successful groups, groups that you think combine these issues of environmentalism and economic justice. What does, for example, the International Rivers Network do?
IRN is a support organization for grassroots groups around the world. One of the great things about IRN is that it's into global grassroots organizing. It's not a bureaucratic group.
And takes on these international monetary institutions.
Yeah, and IRN is one of the groups that has, over the last 5 or 10 years, bred a milieu in which grassroots and radical people nevertheless get increasingly sophisticated about the structure of international finance and international power. I mean, to take on the World Bank meant learning a lot.
In fact, James Wolfensohn, a Clinton appointee at the World Bank, the president of the World Bank, talks about the 50 Years Is Enough campaign. Its strategy actually took it to the highest levels of recognition around the world.
I mean, people in the 50 Years Enough Is Enough campaign are on first name terms with many of the execs at the bank because they have to deal with the movement.
But has the bank, the World Bank, and in fact the Clinton administration, and a lot of the corporations that were attacked by environmental groups a long time ago, in the end, have they won? It's called sort of the greening of these organizations. There's a lot of talk about the greening of the World Bank and that there's a kind of PR language that's now used that takes the edge off environmental, just what they're actually doing in different places.
Yeah, I have a section in the book on the bank, which is a subsection of the section on greenwashing. I actually call the bank the Temple of Greenwash, which is what somebody called it a long time ago. There's absolutely no question that greenwashing is becoming more and more fundamental to understanding what's going on in the corporations and also among the politicians. Wolfensohn is a very intelligent man and is very, very sophisticated about the manipulation of appearances. The result with the bank is that you get some high profile, you're getting some high profile reforms, but the general thrust of the main body of program and project-based lending has not really changed that significantly.
Do you believe that these institutions have to be abolished, or do you think there's any hope for reform?
That's a difficult question because the best strategy for reform may be to demand abolition.
Tom Athanasiou, author of Divided Planet, The Ecology of Rich and Poor. Now, in your book, you talk about the Rio Summit. This is a place Vice President Gore went down to. Gore is considered, you know, the great environmentalist. Just having him there, having written his book on the environment, makes it look like the Clinton administration is an environmental administration. And yet here they have passed NAFTA. They have pushed GATT. What is your assessment of Vice President Gore?
My assessment of Vice President Gore is that it's too bad he's Vice President Gore. I mean, I don't really see why he has to be flacking for neoliberalism. And he appears in his best moments to know better. And yet,
can I stop you for a second? Because I think neoliberalism is a buzzword that not a lot of people really understand.
Well, I mean, neoliberalism is the ideology of the global, of the corporate globalizers. It's the ideology of the transnational corporate. It says that that the market and the rule of the market is just and inevitable, and it's the invisible hand. The invisible hand think of the invisible hand holding the whole planet in its grasp. That's neoliberalism. Its flagship publications are The Economist, published in London, The Financial Times. It's the dominant ideology of the transnationals, and it may be less powerful than many people think. It may in fact be that the neoliberal vision of transnational corporate globalization is in decline relative to a new capitalist regionalism coming up particularly in Asia, where by and large the ruling elites are not adherents of neoliberal ideology. So it's a complicated story. But Gore and Clinton clearly are neoliberals. Clinton is a more effective neoliberal than the Republicans ever have been, because they have to deal with their sort of Neanderthal nationalist wing, which defines their party politically. So, you know, the question, I suppose, is how to concoct a democratic green alternative to the model of globalization put together by the neoliberals. And Gore, even though he pays lip service to such a democratic form of globalization, in reality is firmly in the camp of corporate globalization. He is also, by the way, pro-nuclear.
Why?
He just is. I mean, he doesn't talk about nuclear power very much, but if you look at what he actually does, he's pro-nuclear, and he supports what's called, you know, the new generation of quote-unquote passively safe nuclear power plants. They're better than the nukes we have now, but we don't need nuclear power at all, and we cannot have a nuclear economy without nuclear weapons proliferation. And nuclear weapons proliferation in the emerging extremely chaotic world is not a good thing.
I don't know if we're going to get much information on this from the networks, an issue we keep coming back to with both NBC, owned by General Electric, CBS, owned by Westinghouse. They are owned by nuclear weapons manufacturers. Mm. You know, speaking of globalization, this weekend, beginning tonight, actually, here in Washington, D.C., is the International Forum on Globalization's second teach-in in the last few months, the first being in New York in October. And we're going to be playing some of the speeches next week of the globalization conference. But maybe you can talk about the significance of these mass meetings that are taking place around the country. In New York, they expected a couple hundred people. They got more than 1,500 people from around the world, some of the speakers being, for example, Vandana Shiva, the well-known Indian anti-globalization activist.
Yes, the very well-known Indian global activist, more well-known here than in India. I would really recommend that people go to the globalization conference if they're in D.C. It's a really stellar lineup of non-governmental thinkers. And
what do you think they've accomplished over these years? This word globalization itself, I guess, is not one people knew about too much a few years ago.
Well, I mean, there's actually a debate about whether or not globalization is a good buzzword for describing what's happening on the planet. But under the umbrella of the globalization teach-ins, there is some very, very hot stuff and very, very interesting stuff being said. And another interesting thing, by the way, about why the globalization teach-ins are so great, have been so great, is that they've brought in a lot of young people. It's not just that 2,000 people or 1,500 people came to the New York meeting. It's that many of them are people who are just beginning their political education.
We have to wrap up, but I have to ask if you agree with the assessment of the mainstream media that environmentalists were able to roll back the biggest changes that the Republicans' Congress wanted to pass. Do you think there have been environmental successes in the last year?
Under the Clinton administration, I think that he's kept the Republicans from the Republican right from pursuing its anti-environmental agenda and revealed the fact that the Republican leadership is out of touch even with its own base on the issue of environmental protection. Having said that, I will also say that it appears to me that Clinton has saved the Republican Party from self-destructing by restraining it, and I'm not sure that's a good thing.
So you wouldn't call President Clinton an environmentalist?
I'm sure he believes that he's an environmentalist. Al Gore is seriously an environmentalist. He, by the way, actually wrote that book,
Earth and the Balance.
Yeah. And but there's a lot of people.
And yet, would you say that NAFTA and GATT are the greatest threats to the environment that we have known in many decades?
I'm not sure I would say that, not as you just said it. I mean, I think that neoliberalism is extremely dangerous, but it's not the only extremely dangerous thing happening on the planet.
Well, doesn't it lay the framework? It allows the corporations to go unrestrained to do their work around the world.
Yeah, and that's certainly a problem, but I don't think the problem is the corporations. I think it's capitalist development per se. And so you then have to ask the question of what role the transnationals play vis-a-vis capitalist development. As I said before, the People's Liberation Army in China is emerging as a highly diverse, consolidated conglomeration using slave labor. I mean, it's not GE, but it's a corporation.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Tom Athanasiou, for joining us, author of Divided Planet, The Ecology of Rich and Poor. It's put out, published by Little Brown. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin at the studios of WPFW. Kenneth Mason has been our engineer. Special thanks to Bob Daughtry, his support, ever ongoing. And we want to let you know our address. You can write to us at Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. We welcome all sorts of political satire and music to add to Democracy Now! On Monday, we look at globalization. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.